Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Traditional economics measures the ways in which we spend our income, but doesn't attribute worth to the crucial human interactions that give our lives meaning. Claire Brown, an economics professor at UC Berkeley and a practicing Buddhist, has developed a holistic model, one based on the notion that quality of life should be measured by more than national income. She's written a book entitled Buddhist Economics, An Enlightened Approach to the Dismal Science. A note about Claire Brown, again, she is a professor of economics and director of the Center for Work, Technology, and Society at the University of California, Berkeley. An economist focusing on work and economic justice, she is a past director of the Institute of Industrial Relations at Berkeley and chair of the Committee on Education Policy of the UCB Academic Senate. She lives in Richmond, California, and she is with us today. Welcome, Dr. Brown.
Thank you. It's so nice to join you.
Sure. I mentioned that this is one of two books, when we spoke before the program, one of two books on economics that I've read and understood at least some of it. And I can assure listeners that if economics is not your bailiwick, this is an excellent introduction. I think it is really written well for laymen. But I'm curious about the title, An Enlightened Approach, the subtitle, rather, An Enlightened Approach to the Dismal Science. Why is it the Dismal Science?
Well, economists have never been the most popular people, because every time someone comes up with the way to enjoy life or to try and do things in a better way, economists keep saying, well, yes, yes, that's a benefit, but what about the cost? So we're always reminding people, what about the cost? And then from a macro viewpoint, just as the economy is doing really well and taking off and people are finally getting jobs and wages might be rising, all of a sudden economists come in and say, oh, I'm sorry, we're going to take away the punch bowl now because we don't want inflation. And that also makes economists be practicing a dismal science. So we are, as I said, we're not the most popular people around. But we can also think about economics in a broader, more holistic way, because the dismal science really doesn't think about sort of the human spirit or how to create a meaningful life.
It reminds me of so many people in various professions that say, oh my gosh, I remember when I started out in my career, I was passionate about it. It was rewarding. I loved it. And then the bean counters took over. These people who have no experience in the industry itself, but they do have an experience. They have excellent experience in accounting. And really, their main focus is the bottom line. You can see a shared understanding there, eh?
Yes, yes, that's a really, really good example and a really nice way to think about, oh, if we're just going to focus on national income, or as economists like to think about it, we really want to minimize cost. Let's be efficient. There's this huge focus on efficiency. With the size of the pie or minimizing cost or maximizing profits being the goal. But when you step back and say, gee, is the economy producing well-being and giving people a high quality of life, then that's not going to be answered by the bean counters.
You know, it's interesting that you're talking about religion and economics, or philosophy and economics, because I've always understood them to have a very similar, a common thread, if you will. And that is that religion and economics are an awful lot about belief and ideology. And once you hang your hat on a religion or hang your hat on an ideology, You're going to stick with it through thick and thin, even when counter evidence is staring you right in the face, because you're both in position. Someone who belongs to a religion, particularly those religions that require a significant amount of expression of faith, you are anticipating an outcome, and you can't prove that outcome. Economists do the same thing, right? You belong to this particular school of economics, and you are at war with this other school of economics, and you have the same data, but you have different outcomes. Has that been frustrating for you in the field of economics?
I think it's extremely frustrating, especially even when we're teaching. The simplest model in economics is the free market or competitive model, and we teach it because it's so simple and it has assumptions that we don't observe in the real world, but hey, it's easy to teach. And also, if all the assumptions were fulfilled of competition and everybody having opportunity to do whatever they want to do, then it's a very fair model. But the only problem is the model. If you go out and look in the real world, free markets don't really exist, and the economy, without a lot of sort of structuring by the government and help by the government, ends up causing enormous inequality and enormous damage to the environment. And so you're right. We have this ideology where you still hear, especially politicians, saying, oh, no, no, the market will take care of everything. We must leave it alone. But we also have all the economists showing us studies that that's not true, that we need to deal with inequality, we need to deal with environmental degradation, and we can. We know how to do it. And once again, you end up with your ideology.
Right, and certainly the same could be true for someone in a communist state, right? That no matter what the data says, they would say, no, this is the system that will get us to where we want to be, correct?
That's well put, yes, yes.
And it is interesting as well that many people, they almost commit idolatry with this free, with this invisible hand, I would say, right? no matter what, this magic hand is going to take care of everything. Were you ever a part of that philosophy?
No, but I was certainly trained that way. And you know, but I'm an institutional economist, which means that we understand that all markets are structured by both the government and by social norm and custom. And that markets are no, you know, they just don't magically appear, but they're structured by the society to make the economy work. And that each society picks their own level of inequality and picks their own environmental degradation. And those are social choices. And you can look around the world and see all kinds of different outcomes based upon the policies that the government has and the social culture. And political scientists call this varieties of capitalism. But you can see all these different outcomes. And so economists can tell us, hey, you want this outcome for inequality or equity? These are your policies. You want something else? These are your other policies. So economists have lots of policies to offer. The problem is often they're ignored.
And you say that these policies that are given have a degree of substance to them, that we can learn from them. Is that right?
Yes, and we have learned from them, because the nice thing when there's so many different types of policies in various countries, then we can make the comparisons and start to learn, oh, in this country, when we had this policy, we got this outcome. And we do this comparative analysis that's really quite helpful. And right now, we see in the U.S., we're going from a focus on trying to reduce environmental degradation and quit putting so much carbon in the air under the Obama administration to the Trump administration, where we're saying, oh, full steam ahead with fossil fuel. We don't need to worry. It can give us all the economic growth we want, and we don't need to worry about carbon emissions. So we're really changing our policies, and we're going to see very different outcomes.
This book, we're talking about Buddhist economics. Obviously, we're talking about an economic model that is based on what are often referred to as dharmic principles, or principles of the Buddha and perhaps other great masters as well. Would you say that there could be books out there on Christian economics and Jewish economics that mirror what you're saying, simply because they are attempting to come up with a model that is the best for the most people?
Oh, I think absolutely. And in my book, I mentioned that you go across all the major religions, and they all have some form of the golden rule about treating people as you would treat others. And of course, they all talk about relieving suffering and sharing the good life across the world. Where Buddhism is slightly different is that there's no God. There's only the inner Buddha in each of us. And so from that you get the premise and the assumption that we're all interconnected. Everyone's interconnected. And then also that we're interconnected with nature. And so in Buddhist economics, it's based upon this idea of interconnectedness, and therefore the suffering of one person is the suffering of all. So think about it this way. Think about the visualization that we call Indra's net, which I think is a great visualization for Buddhists, and actually Hindus also. That each jewel, think of this infinite net, and in each corner of it, each time the strings meet in the net, there's a jewel. And the jewel reflects all the other jewels. And so within any jewel, and each jewel is very beautiful, you see the reflection of the entire net. And that relates to the interconnectedness of people and of nature. And once you do that, then any time something happens to one jewel, it's reflected in all the jewels.
That makes a great deal of sense, because you're talking about making sure that there is equity amongst all who would be affected by whatever economic policy you're attempting to implement, correct?
That's right. And you especially don't want to cause suffering. You want to relieve suffering. So that there's not just a focus on, what's happening on the average, but we care enormously about the distribution of what's happening across all people, especially those at the bottom.
It is interesting, too, that in our society, and this has been going on for decades, is that the idea of a free market, as we've been talking about it so far, people who are in charge, so to speak, not necessarily economists themselves, but I would say the captains of industry and politicians, have attempted to relate it to religion, specifically Christianity. That a good Christian is a free marketeer, and that anything that would upset that balance is suspect at best.
You know, I think the person that I really follow in this area is Pope Francis, because he's made it very, very clear that the free market isn't helping a lot of people, and that it's the Christian duty to care about everyone. And then in his proclamation, Laudato Si, which was his love letter to Earth, as it were, he makes it really clear. He says, hey, look, well, he was a climate scientist, and he understands chemistry. But he says to everyone, you know what? When you put carbon in the air, from driving your car, heating your home, from everything you do, every time you put carbon in the air, you're actually harming life and harming people. And that's not okay. That's actually a sin. And so he was very clear that we have to care for everyone around the world and in their lives, but we also have to care about nature and what we're doing to nature. And so I think he probably gives the best argument of all the Christian leaders sort of against what happens if you just let the free market take over.
He would be the exception to the rule of the example that I was giving, because I've just heard for decades that the people don't come right out and say it, that Jesus was a free marketeer. They don't say that, but you know there is a very strong conservative Christian establishment in this country that promotes free markets. Have you heard of the Acton Institute?
Yes, but I don't really stay in touch with it.
Okay. They're headquartered here in Grand Rapids, by the way.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can almost see their building from where I sit if I had a window. I do want to mention, by the way, that if people are just tuning in, this is WGVU. The program is Common Threads, and my name is Fred Stella, and I'm speaking with Dr. Claire Brown on her book, Buddhist Economics, An Enlightened Approach to the Dismal Science. So earlier we were talking about the idea that these theories can exist in some sort of alternative universe. For instance, the idea that markets are best run without any government interference whatsoever, any regulation, but we can't find the solid proof that this in fact works. It's a theory. What about the model that you propose, this Buddhist, this Dharmic economic plan that would, in your eyes, be wonderful if it was instituted here in this country? Can you look to any other societies, past or present, where the ideas of a Dharmic understanding of economics have allowed the country or the society to flourish?
Well, certainly we can look to the social democracies in Europe that have done much better at reducing inequality. And then, once again, we can look to European countries, especially now France and Germany, that are really pushing forward to going to a green economy to make the economy sustainable and to improve human health and life. So we have those two. And then that leaves us with sort of the third aspect, which is reducing suffering or trying to have shared prosperity. And for that, we go to the United Nations, where with their Millennium Development Goals and then their Sustainable Development Goals, there has been with focused resources to reduce extreme poverty and extreme hunger and also improve education and improve the human rights for women and children. They have done amazing things. So it just shows that if we want to put our resources and our goals and work together globally, we can, in fact, reduce inequality. We can make the economy and the world more sustainable. And we can reduce suffering, especially related to extreme poverty, extreme hunger, and human rights, and education.
It's interesting. Oh,
so
go ahead.
We can find these ways of putting them all together.
And in the litany of the countries you've just mentioned, you didn't indicate any Buddhist majority nation, past or present. So I'm just curious if you can tell me why.
Well, mainly because, well, let's just take Bhutan. It's such a small country. And one could say they practice Buddhist economics. One could even go to Sri Lanka, which had a horrible civil war and now is trying very hard to transition to a Buddhist economy. They invited me there to actually help them talk about what would they do, how would they do it. You can go to other countries, though, Thailand, Cambodia. So you find, let me tell you, here's one of the biggest problems, and I think it points out to everything you've said so far, that it's hard to integrate sort of what the monastics want to say or what the spiritual leaders say into some form of everyday life and how the economy and society functions. And that's always been one of, I think, our biggest challenges, is how to integrate the spiritual life into the materialistic life and make it work. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, is I think it's possible, especially now that we all our countries are so rich. And in the rich countries, we can quit focusing on minimizing cost and the size of the pie and focus much more about what's in the pie, what's in our lives, and also how to share it. So one of the other problems is that in the Asian countries, they're much poorer, they're much further behind us. And so it's much harder for them to think about, oh, well, now we all have so much. Let's focus on our spiritual and human nature.
Yeah, and certainly there is the risk that they're going to replicate where we have been, right? To get as much as you can, unfortunately, and try to copy the Western model of what they think success is. I see that happening. I talk to my friends in India, people who are from India, and they see this revolution, which they're really excited about because, hey, it certainly isn't living on the streets. But at the same time, many of them also agree that perhaps they're taking it a little bit too far when they're working something like, 18 hours a day.
Well, I think for the developing world, especially China and India, because they're so large, that there are two issues. One is basically how to raise the standard of living, because we need to. We need to increase consumption, especially for food, clean water, shelter, education, health care, creating community, family life. We need to do that in the developing world, but we can't do it based upon fossil fuel. And so we need to have them leapfrog to clean energy technology, which we have, which they can do. So we don't want them to replicate a fossil fuel economy, and we also don't want them to replicate that the goal is for everybody to live like they're rich. I mean, they also struggle enormously with their inequality. And one of the problems with inequality is that when you have vast inequality, then you have everybody trying to replicate the lifestyle, the lavish lifestyle at the top. And even though they could be having comfortable, healthy, sustainable lives, they don't feel that well off because they make these invidious comparisons to those at the top. And so one of the reasons that we want to reduce inequality is that when you reduce inequality, it actually makes everyone feel better off, because now in a relative sense, they are better off. And their comparisons to others say, oh, look, we actually have a comfortable, secure life. We should feel good about it.
Well said. I'm curious, have you visited Bhutan? You mentioned Bhutan just a few minutes ago.
No, but I'm going to be going this fall. I look forward to going.
Oh, I would too. Unfortunately, the problem with Bhutan, people have been giving that an awful lot of attention in the last few years because of their gross domestic happiness. Is that how do they rephrase that? Right,
the
gross domestic happiness, yes, as opposed to gross domestic product. But I can't think of Bhutan, as lovely as it, I'm sure it is, without also talking about how they displaced about 100,000 Nepali refugees, which was terribly unfortunate a couple of decades ago. I work with Bhutanese refugees, and they loved Bhutan. They speak of it with such relish, so many great memories. Unfortunately, it only takes one despot to rock the boat and make lives miserable for people. But that said, I'm sure that for the people who are there, that if everything I've read and from everything these refugees have talked about, it's a pretty amazing place. I would imagine you're going to have a wonderful time there.
Yeah, but I agree with you that any time one group of people harms the other group, it goes against every religion. But yet we keep doing it. And we can see that the Buddhists in Myanmar have done terrible things to the minority there. So it's not like As you point out, you know, we can be ideological, and it's not like our spiritual life is going to make sure that we always behave correctly.
Exactly. Claire, we are down to the wire for this particular episode, but this has been a great conversation. I'd love to have you back next week if you can.
Oh, I look forward to it.
Do you have a website?
Yes, it's called BuddhistEconomics.net.
Okay, BuddhistEconomics.net. Well, thank you so much, Claire, for joining us today. My name is Fred Stella. You've been listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. And Claire Brown has been our guest today. She is the author of Buddhist Economics, An Enlightened Approach to the Dismal Science. Please join us again next week for more conversation here on Common Threads.